non-Village Corporation representative at this meeting. The Petersburg Indian Association has allowed me to travel here to express some of the concerns about ANSCA. As I see it, ANSCA has affected Petersburg in at least three ways. One, personally, two, our tribal, and three, termination. Each of these I will attempt to describe briefly. The personal part of the ANSCA is very disturbing. First of all, I was never asked how I felt about a settlement. My parents were involved, so I had knowledge about a land claim that I would receive in my lifetime. Many times I was reminded about the land claims because my mother had to spend hours at meetings and hours writing letters supporting land claims. Yet when it came down to brass tacks, bureaucrats told me what I wanted, how I wanted it, who was going to be in charge of it. And this was going to change my lifestyle drastically and dramatically. In listening to those that took on my responsibility of my life, dreams of no longer being in poverty were just around the corner. Well, 12 years have gone by. I still live in poverty. An average of $585 a year since land claims made a significant change in my life. You may think that this sounds facetious, but it's not. It's a fact. Tribal-wise, we are an IRA. We are a tribe reorganized in 1948. But in 1905 in Petersburg, there were very few people. In fact, other than Peter Bushman, after which Petersburg is named, John Lott is the only other significant name. John Lott is the first Native founder in Petersburg. His name for Petersburg is Sitka, place where the water flows fast, like a river. He owned all of the beach and was not bothered by anyone until the people that owned the land above the beach needed it for commercial enterprise. He, like the rest of the Alaska Natives, did not believe that the lands were being taken away from them. As time passed, he was left with only a house. And others that joined him in Petersburg were left with the same status. The BIA played a small part in protecting our rights. We were given restricted deeds. We were not given an education in how to protect them. Today, all the restricted land is gone. The land claim started to gain momentum, and the leaders in Petersburg were distressed about how little we knew about what was happening. Natives in Petersburg missed out on the chance to have an allotment that could have been granted to them before the December deadline in 1971. The BIA failed to inform the members of the Petersburg Indian Association. The members of the Petersburg Indian Association still had high hopes about land. Because of the impetus throughout Alaska for it, united the Alaska Natives. They went to Congress together and knew that they could get something done. What happened in Washington never reached us until it was too late. We were left out. We were forced to be at large, and we were told we would get immediate benefits that were not going to be available to those that were able to join a village corporation. Money blinded many of us. It blinded us for quite a few years. About 5 years ago, we started realizing what we lost. We watched the at-large corporations give millions to village corporations while telling us we could not get a dime because if they gave us a dime, they'd have to give a dime to all the shareholders. This is a great inequity for Petersburg. Had we been able to form a corporation in ANSCA, we could have been given this very special treatment that the village corporations received. We and three other towns have been grossly mistreated. No corporation, no land, and no money. My third statement is termination. I spent hours that makes studying the ANSCA Corporation or the ANSCA Act, and I feel somewhat qualified to make the following statement. I've discussed the statement with credible people. The most qualified is David Case. He explained more to me about ANSCA than anything I ever read or any workshop, seminar, or corporation manager, has ever informed me of. He agrees. The ANSCA is a termination document. It is an instrument that Congress can use to stop dealing in Alaska, especially with Alaska Natives. The ANSCA has more or less defined the Alaska Native. They are no longer Natives because they're, after 1971, no new Natives were born, so now we are just shareholders, not Natives. And I'd like to just to reiterate that there is about 400 shareholders in Petersburg.
Could you leave your written statement with us, sir?
I'll give you a copy of it.
Fine, thank you. Could I just ask you a couple of questions, just for the record? You said that besides Petersburg, two other towns were...
Three
other towns. I think that those have been discussed already, but which did you have in mind?
Haines, Wrangell, and Ketchikan.
You feel very strongly about all this. Are there any observations you would like to make about 1991? That is, the last speaker, Mr. Scann, said, well, something has to be done to make sure that Native corporations don't fall into non-Native hands. And in other places I've been, people have said, well, there should be restrictions placed on the sale of shares in 1991 so that Native people won't be able to sell their shares. Right now, the corporations have a right of first refusal, that is, they can buy them back if they have the money. But at other places we've been, people have said, well, the best solution is to have the corporations transfer land in trust so that even if the corporations go bankrupt or fall into non-Native hands for one reason or another, the land will be safely held in trust for the Native people. That's why some have said it should be transferred to IRAs to be held in trust, or should be transferred to some other entity to be held in trust. I'm saying this not only for your benefit, but for the benefit of others present here who might wish to comment on that question, but you've been kind enough to come from Petersburg, and maybe I could just, if there's any observations you'd like to make on that.
I've personally thought about it quite in quite depth and discussed it with many people in Petersburg. First of all, 10 years ago it was a different Congress, and to re-educate Congress again about ANSCO is going to be it's a major project, and to enact a law to protect the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act lands is going to be it's going to be expensive, and I think that the date's got to be moved up. I think it has to be changed to such a time when they have Congress educated to the fact that the lands do belong to the people, not to the corporations. I think that the act has to be amended to allow who we consider Natives to have part in that land, no matter what dilution effects it has on corporations, because the corporations are not the Alaska Natives. Corporations is a instrument, a tool. It's designed for profit. The lands belong to the people. My ancestors never made a profit off the land. I don't think that anybody here in this room would like to see just a select few make a profit off the land. So if I was to make a statement, I would think that every Native born after, I think it's December 17th, 1971, should be given 100 shares in the land, making it so diluted so that takeover by large or major corporations such as Weyerhaeuser or ITT Rainier or Japanese firms would be, they'd be reluctant to try to attempt to deal with thousands of more shareholders. I personally think there's probably 20, maybe 25, maybe 30,000 additional shareholders born since 1971, and if each one of them were given 100 shares in the land only, it would help to protect the takeover of the Anska corporations, because all that would remain would be the assets, or I don't know how that's the correct term, but the buildings, the new companies that they have purchased and they are operating, which aren't really that valuable. I speak of maybe Ocean Beauty as a non-land claim type of an asset. So I think that first of all, Congress has to be re-educated and to really resolve the problem, which has been around more than just the last 12 years. It's been around all of my lifetime. I can remember first hearing about land claims when I was 10 years old. That's my first recollection of land claims, because my mother was involved in the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood Grand Camp, and they were the only organization at that time fighting for land claims, and now they're completely out of the picture. So it is a big problem. It's going to take more than just a move by the corporation to protect them. It's going to have to take a federal law, and to get that federal law is going to take a lot of hard work, such as they went through to get the land claims in the first place. And I really appreciate having to be able to take some of your time up.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Guthrie, and thank you very much. I should say that this commission has a legal advisor, and the commission's legal advisor is Professor David Case of the University of Alaska, who wrote the book on Alaska Natives and the law. And Mr. Guthrie spoke highly of Mr. Case, and I only mention that because Mr. Case is the legal advisor to the commission, but the report of this commission will be based on what people like yourselves say at these hearings. We'll only go to the lawyers to get legal advice after we know what it is you people think about ANCSA and where you want to go from here. At any rate, I'm sure Mr. Case will be pleased that he's well thought of in Southeast Alaska. Mr. David Austin, I think, is next.
Thank you. My name is David Austin. I'm from Juneau area. My greetings to the elders and to brothers and sisters of AMBNS that might be in the crowd. I come from the Wishkiton Shark House, the same place that the Honorable Judge Berger alluded to in Angoon with Mr. Jimmy George. My Tlingit name is Satanish. My beliefs on the land claims are that armed with the Bible, the Magna Carta, the U.S. Constitution, that they were completely illegal and immoral. Because the Bible states that you should not steal or covet or kill, and all of these things happened to the peoples of Alaska, the Russian people who came over here, and in the history books that are available to any citizen, slaughtered the Aleut people like dogs. And then hence from there, they sold something that wasn't theirs to sell to the United States government, who broke their own laws by accepting property that was gotten under duress, murder, deceit. I do not wish to sell my land. I consider myself at this time a political prisoner of the United States. I've not really thought about being a citizen of the United States since I was a teenager, when I witnessed that everybody's equal in Alaska, it's just some are more equal as far as going to, I remember in 1978, Alaska Native Sisterhood had a study done on the sentencing procedures of Alaska Natives versus Caucasian people. And on any given occasion, I can't remember which law firm it was from New York, they stated that a Native would receive up to 3 times the amount of time under the same law that was broken. I worked for Sea Alaska soliciting proxies in Juneau in 1978 under the supervision of Mr. Chris McNeil, and I worked for them in Seattle, and I worked for them under Carmen Plunkett in 1982 in Anchorage. I've talked to a lot of shareholders over the years from, I've lived in Bethel, I've been out to, I lived up in the place Gold Cannon where you were talking about. I lived with the Ewan family up there. I lived in Fairbanks, Cordova. I've come to Ketchikan off and on for 18 years, having friends in this area. I know the apathy that Mr. Mather spoke about. I know that when I go to a shareholder's house, that they didn't care who they voted for. The first question that was asked was, when are we gonna get some money and how much? And they told me to vote for the people that I was working for. They complained about the fact that Sea Alaska was paying me and 10 other people a fair wage, not an outrageous wage, and having us make long distance telephone calls, put in lots of hours to keep the incumbent board in, the people that were in power. And it was pretty easy since they had access to all 17,000 Sea Alaska shareholders through addresses. Granted, I believe a copy that can be obtained for $300 or $400. Although people are just apathetic. They're not satisfied with land claims. I think one of the main topics I've heard, and I've never heard a dissenting view on this and all the shareholders that I've ever talked to, was that 42 million acres that was allegedly given to the Alaska Native peoples, not to the corporations. Where is it for the common man to get to go out there and have something? I don't allude to be, I don't want to be a white man. I don't want to wear a three-piece suit, and I want to live in Alaska, but I don't like to live under the restrictions where I cannot fish except for subsistence. If I want to fish, it's going to cost me $150,000 to get a permit, or $50,000. I just say that I have not sold my land. That is it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Austin. Mr. Austin mentioned something that has come up at other meetings, that is that the officers and board of directors of a corporation are able to use corporate funds to employ people like Mr. Austin to solicit proxies in order to remain in office. Now, that is something that just about every corporation in the United States, Native or non-Native, and every corporation in Canada, and any place else I know of, does. It's a common practice. Now, it may be one that causes resentment among Native shareholders, but it isn't something that occurs only within Native corporations. It's a feature of life in corporate America, and I think that should be said, that's all. I've run out of names here, so we're open for business if anyone else would like to make a presentation at this time.
Morning, Your Honor. I'm Al Jackson of the shareholders of Sea Alaska and Kwakenia Corporation. And my friend Dewey Scan, Mr. Scan, has touched upon something that I've been looking for some time, as I want to make a comment on, and that's the 160-acre native allotment claims, which is the individual claims, as you know, which was supposed to have been settled before, I believe, the land was turned over to the village corporations in 1981. This has not been done and has been turned down essentially by the government under the claim that they could not prove that they lived on the land since 1911, when it became a national forest. Now, Mr. Scan has pointed out that the federal government asked the native people from the outlying areas to move into a more central location so as to provide them with schools and other needs. After the natives moved as requested, they are now told that they can't claim this land because they haven't lived on it for a long period of time. Seems to me there's a conflict there, a legal conflict. I believe I'll request that you bring this up to Mr. Case for his opinion. I don't believe this has ever been brought up. The opening paragraph of the original agreement between the United States and Russia, I've been told, and I believe Mr. Kogo reminded me of this too, stated that the natives of Alaska would not be disturbed in their natural habitat. This has long since been broken. I firmly believe that if the natives had not been encroached upon their land, that a lot of us would still be living out there, so that there would be no question as to whether the land was theirs. The Forest Service, as known, went around and destroyed smokehouses and other places of habitat as recently as the 1950s under the guise that these are fire hazards, but they're effectively removing any evidence that it was used. My own grandfather's property was done to as late as 1965, I believe. There are other things which I want to touch on too, but I don't want to take too much time on this, but this is one of my complaints. As known that the Supreme Court has essentially turned down the request of the 160-acre native allotment claims because the people could not prove that they had lived on it since 1911 or had used it continuously. But the very fact that they did ask them to move in to a more central location, and because the land was encroached upon, I'll give one of my own villages as an example. I believe Mr. Scan and Mr. Johnson back there can verify that Staney Creek, which is one of the biggest fishing streams on Prince of Wales Island, there was a fish trap that was built right on the flats of this creek. The piling were high and dry at low tide. And this essentially helped wipe out this stream. And this is what I'm talking about, encroachment. The biggest village, Winter Village, was Tuxican Village. All these other outlying areas would go there in the wintertime, and this was only, 3 to 5 miles from Staney Creek area. Because it was protected, it was good hunting, and this was a big fishing stream. They essentially were Tuxican Village, and all these others moved into Klawak, essentially as the government asked. And this is one of my chief concerns at this time, if you'd bring that to Mr. Case's attention for me. Hopefully I'll have time to make a few more comments later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
I hope you all can hear me. My name is Esther Haverkamp, and I'd like to thank you for all the work you've been doing with my people. Also thank the Inuit Circumpolar Conference for allowing these hearings to go on. I appreciate the points that Mr. Thomas brought up. Mr. Paul has done an awful lot of work for land claims from way back, and Ketchikan was left out of the Native land claims. One of the first reasons I found out was because the white society was too strong politically to begin with when this was all going on. There is an old Indian, an old federal law that for as long as the grass shall grow and all that, that the natives can always park their canoes there, right there at the Tongass dock, to the mouth of Ketchikan Creek used to go from Thomas Basin clean over to Nordby's. That was the mouth of the creek. There was an old shaman's rock found there. It had to be an extra low tide. This little boy found a shaman's rock there in Ketchikan Creek, and mother doesn't want a piece of it chipped out to find out how old it is, because that's an extremely rare find. I also know that when they were running around trying to get people to sign up for, or to say, yes, let's go ahead on the land claims, they were telling them, well, if you sign, then Ketchikan will get the money. I also have to agree with Mr. Thomas in that there is a great dichotomy between the corporate structure and the tribal structure. And it has caused some difficulties, and when you look at the two, you can't look at them quite the same way. I'm concerned about the question of 1991. If we lose the land, we lose everything. And I feel about the land in two ways. One, I love it. As much of Alaska as I've seen, I love it. It's the most beautiful place that I've ever laid eyes on, getting partial to Southeast. The other one, it's because I can understand the Jews when they say, I want to have one place where I'm free to get away from a lot of the garbage that's happening in the world that we live in today. I feel that we should have a tremendous push toward educating all of us. It should be a shareholder-wide decision. This decision as to what will happen to us in 1991 and how our lands are going to be treated should not be left up to just our leadership. It should be within each one of us to say and determine what happens to our land. And we're not going to be able to deal with all the complexities of this particular problem unless we are educated. And we're going to need that tremendously. Well, thank you, and Dewey Scan, thank you so very much. The other thought I'd like to just leave you with is back in the old days when a leader didn't lead you right, you put him away and found another one that treated you properly. Those were requiring special values from the leader, to respect his people, to think of them and the unborn generations and the generations before in guiding us and determining what our future is going to be. So I should hope that we don't lose those values when we consider this question.
Thank you very much, Ms. Haverkamp.
Yeah, the only other thing I like to say is we know the land like we know the land. We can take care of our land if we're going to combine it with white education. Our children, they have a right to it.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
A Good evening. As far as the Alaska land claims, I'm reminded.
You have your name.
Frederick Williams.
Thank you.
Kowak Ketchikan. I'd like to say I'm reminded of the Bible, a story we're all familiar with in the Bible. Solomon and the two mothers that came to him disputing a baby child. The one mother had lost her child and claimed the other mother's child. Solomon, in his wisdom, mentioned that the way to do it would be to divide the child. And now we have the rightful mother said, no, I'd rather give up my child than to see my child in two. And to me, that's the position we as natives are in. We've had a choice to sell the land, which we don't believe we own, or to give it up for a mere sum of money. We've taken a mere sum of money and we've given control of our land over to another in order to preserve that land. We still have that land, but we have given it up. I think it's a fine choice. As my grandfather said, we're Americans now, and I'm proud to be American. It's a good country. It's the Constitution is one of the finest pieces of paper in the world. And we'll go on, but one thing we have to remember is that America's only had Alaska for 100 years. America's only been in existence for 200 years. And when all these pretentious claims are gone, and we will still be here, regardless of what money has been spent, regardless of what papers have been signed, the papers will be gone. The only thing that will still be here is our blood and our land. It's my belief that the land owns the people. And the Tlingit people will never be the same after this, but all of life, I think, is a growing experience. And our people, in the generations to come, will come through it. And this will still be native land when all is said and done. As long as we can hold together our cultures and our values and pass them on to future generations. And I think each one of us, I see a lot of people in here that I know are making those efforts. They're passing them on, regardless of what papers they sign, regardless of what proxy statements they get. In the back of their minds, they know that this land belongs to their children, and it hasn't been sold. And what papers were signed under stress, duress. And so they are phony papers, and we'll stand up to them as long as we who signed them have to, but the day will come when our future generations didn't sign that paper, will still be here, and they'll still have claim to the land. The strongest, the proper leaders will be chosen, and our society will go on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
All the grim faces in here today. My name's Paul Young. I'm a man in the street, so I'll give the man in the street view on this whole matter. I was sitting down here jotting down notes, reading the handouts, and a thing struck me as this was going along is what was the, looking at what the intent of the Alaska land claims was when they were bargaining for something in exchange for something else, a commodity called Aboriginal rights. They were exchanging it for something else. What was that something else? Was it a corporation that was to build itself into a into an IT&T, or do we just create a monster that's gobbling up our land and gobbling up our people? In the past, we valued those systems that said that we share and share alike. When others don't have, we share with them. The way the corporation board of directors behaves, you would think they were on the board of Sohio, and their main purpose in life was to make money for money's sake. I was thinking back, if the intent of the Alaska land claims was to perpetuate a corporation indefinitely, and that's where we're going to put all our energies and all of our talents, and it's drawing our people away into a pool, a talent pool, and trying to bring about some sort of change. What is that change we're trying to bring about? Are we trying to better our position in the socioeconomic systems of Alaska as U.S. citizens, as Alaskan citizens? If that was the intent of the Alaska land claims, it failed. If we look at the number of people who have become independently wealthy, there are none around other than those who have managed to struggle and grab for the top. Is it a training ground for our young Indian people to become productive citizens in a capitalist society? Perhaps that's what we wanted in the first place. I don't know. There's more questions than there are answers. I don't want to feel like I'm just sitting up here complaining without coming up with some alternative to this, but I don't know what the alternatives are. I think we have to sit down and decide what questions to ask before we start coming up with answers. We're doing this thing ass backwards. We're starting out with answers and saying we need to move back and do this and do that, then we'll reach this, rather than having a defined goal in mind. We understand the American dream. We know what the American dream is. What's the Indian dream? What do the Indians want? Have we ever sat down and discussed among ourselves what those things are that are important to us, rather than saying, well, how come there's no dividend? What does that accomplish? Does that make us better people? Does it make us better Haidas, better Tsimsheans, because Sea Alaska declared a dividend? I don't think so. I think what we're doing is we're sitting here discussing something that is the very essence of our being. We are Indian people. Let's decide what it is that we are and move toward enforcing and supporting that. There are a lot of important things. My mother never taught me my language. I feel very deprived. But I learned what it was like to live in a village, to share, and to be like one in working together toward a common goal. We went back and we discussed about health, and we combat that problem of TB, of infant mortality. Infant mortality rates in Alaska, everybody said these things are terrible, let's do something about it. And we did something about it because we felt we had the right to live like everyone else in this country. We talked about education. We told our kids, go get an education, come back and help your people, climb that ladder of success and earn your eagle feather, and reach down and pull up your people with you. And when they reached down, you ignored them. What are we doing? I think that's one of the basic questions the entire act is supposed to answer. What is it we wanted? Why did we want it? I think we have to get back and step back and look at it and clear our eyes from acting like a bunch of piranha when you throw meat in the water. It just like the fish going up the creek. We're all grabbing. We want something. We want something for ourselves. I had no expectations with the Alaska land claims because I didn't expect anything. But I think we should start expecting something. We put a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of talent into it. I guess one of the things too is I'm very concerned about where Indian people are going. We've established all of these systems to support our people in education and health, and and try to branch out into other areas that we haven't explored before. We have cable television. We're learning a lot about what they're doing in Libya, but do we know what they're doing in Huna? I think these are kind of things that we need to think about. We think we're sophisticated now. We think we know everything there is to know, but yet we don't even know ourselves. Let's put up a mirror and talk to each other and reflect on what we're saying and not just speak empty words. So I think if I get anything else out of this, at least it stimulates my thought. This is what I'm doing here. I'm pursuing the American dream. I think we all are. But we're doing it in a different manner. If that's the ultimate goal, then let's proceed with it. If the ultimate goal is to step back into time, then let's move in that direction and get rid of our two cars and our two televisions and our humongous bank accounts in United Bank Alaska. Let's go back to being fishermen, gathering seaweed. I think we need to teach our kids our language. I think we need to teach them how to smoke fish. I think we need to teach them how to be proud of themselves. I'm the executive director of Ketchikan Youth Services. We have over 60 kids a day going to there. Majority are Native kids. They don't even know what the hell they're doing because the parents never talk to them. They don't know what they want. And I think that's where we're at ourselves. We need to sit down and counsel ourselves, agree among ourselves, what do we want, and express that to our children. Thank you.
Mr. Young said he spoke for the common man, but I think it was an uncommon man and an uncommon statement. Yes, sir.
I'm Lewis Thompson, president of Kavilko Incorporated, based out of Kasan. And I'd like to discuss a few of the things that I, as I see it, on the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. I agree 100% with most of the people that have testified here so far this evening. I think there's been a lot of injustices with the corporate structure or the intent of the act. And I think there's a lot of misconception with the act. But I'd like to back up a little bit and start from the beginning. Kasan was one of the villages that was named in the act, spelled out as one of the 10 village corporations in Southeastern. However, during our eligibility, determining the eligibility, we were contested by a conservation group as well as the United States Forest Service, stating that we weren't eligible. So that cost us a few dollars to start with, $30,000 to be exact, to go through this hearing. It was a three-day hearing. It was held in Ketchikan, and the Forest Service was the only one that appeared in opposition to our eligibility. However, they didn't, typical of the government, they didn't have their facts, and we won the case. So it was on a technicality, a word, a phrase, a period of time. They had no definition of period of time. And it was a residency requirement under the act. So however, we had 30, 35 people that testified that were residents for a period of time prior to December 18th, 1971. I feel that it's been an uphill battle since the act has passed, being that there's no precedent set with the act. There isn't a judge in the state of Alaska that will make a ruling if anything is contested that pertains to the act. So it's very costly to the village corporations as well as the regional corporations to continue on and battle these minority issues. I guess they're minority issues. But I see that we were put into a circumstance that was kind of a hasty circumstance. I feel that the Native people didn't have adequate time to prepare themselves for the role under the guidelines set by the Act itself, namely either becoming a profit-making corporation or a non-profit corporation, of which 10 village and 2 urban corporations chose to become profit-making corporations. I'm not really that familiar with whether the people that were involved in the negotiations of the Act were able to have the foresight to see the problems that we'd be confronted with at this time. But I feel that we're in a position now that we really have to live with what we have. We have to make do with what we have. I mean, we've been doing this historically with even our ancestors went through this procedure. They had to make do with what they had. So I feel that there's a lot of misconceptions, because I think that the key to the success of the Native people at this point is to coordinate their efforts with the existing structures and mechanisms they have at hand to develop a form of self-determination that would be a success to all Natives, regardless of, you know, they placed the 1/4 blood quantum. And I think, you know, that the Native people in general need to take care of their offspring regardless if they have just a minute blood quantum. I think that, you know, I heard testimony stating that there's some misconceptions as to the role that the Alaska Native Settlement Corporations are to perform. I think that there's misconceptions there, because I think if everybody's familiar with the Tlingit and Haida Judgment Fund that was passed, we gave up, say, 2/3 of, or let's see, we would have received 3 times the land base that we received in lieu of that judgment fund money. So I think that there's an obligation by a nonprofit organization, Native nonprofit organization, to care for a lot of the social and educational needs. I think that the village corporations could work hand in hand with all the other organizations, the IRA or local government. I think there's a role for every one of them. I live in a real small community. There's probably about 60 people that reside there. I think I'm very close to the land. I've lived there most of my life. And I've moved away for a period of time, but 10 years to be exact, working or for seeking unemployment or employment. But I think that I have a pretty good understanding. I've been involved in the village corporation since the formation back in 1972. We were incorporated in 1973, November. I think I have a very good working knowledge, at least I consider I have a good working knowledge of the functions of what we're confronted with, namely the village corporations. I think that it almost seems like there was a plot by the Act of Congress in what they did, because they put us all in the same category where we're resource oriented. We have no other resource, so therefore we're competitive with one another. That further splits some of the thoughts. I think we tried at one time jointly to work together as a timber organization, and it was a failure, because you couldn't get 11 villages and urban corporations, or 12 villages and urban corporations, to work together. There was a lot of conflict, and I think Mr. Scan talked about that. There was a little jealousy in that. But I think that there's other ways that we could work jointly together and you know, become as one. There was a lot of misconceptions, other misconceptions. You never heard of the monetary value. You heard a million dollar settlement plus a vast amount of land. I can't even recall the acreage. But you never heard it broken down on a per capita basis. I think some people addressed a dividend program. The per capita basis of that money was broken down amongst all the Native people. It would be a very small amount dollar-wise. If you broke the land down, it wouldn't, on a per capita basis, it wouldn't be that much. I think that, you know, we're really faced with a unique situation, and I think that there is some alternatives to turning the whole Native organizations around that they could jointly work together and become united. I don't think it takes an act of Congress. I think it takes the people themselves to do that. I think that in my involvement over the period of years, I really think that the 1991 issues and the protection of land is kind of a smokescreen to my estimation. I think that because the land is so encumbered already by the Section 7I of the Act, that I think that there is just too much encumbrance that any outside interest would be willing to come in and try to take it over. And I think that the Native people as a whole have the determination that they won't give up on anything. And somebody referred to the questionnaire that C. Alaska was circulating on, would you sell your stock come 1991? And my answer would be no, because I'd have no reason to sell it. I'd like to see C. Alaska become successful and have it worth something and make it make you proud to be part of that ownership. I think that the 1991 issues are already well covered in the ANILCA amendment. I think that the village corporations under self-determination could take that opportunity to either restrict the stock or develop a plan for a buyback program. And I think somebody raised the question that how would that benefit the or how would it benefit the shareholders on a buyback program? But I think that it would become part of an asset base of the corporation. It would be equally distributed amongst the number of shareholders of that village corporation under a buyback program. It doesn't have to be given to any one individual. It have to be given equally to all the shareholders of the corporation bought it back. And I think that there's other means of protecting it. You know, nobody ever addresses the fact that who is the taxing agency that's going to affect this in 1991? If you're not in an area that has a taxing power, and we live on Prince of Wales Island, so we've been fighting off a borough type of government that comes in our area. There, as far as I'm concerned at this point, I think that the Native corporations have the knowledge and ability to be able to develop strategies or plan of avoiding any tax consequence by any agencies. I'm not confident. I'm confident because I think Mr. Thomas addressed the fact that since 1971, the Native people have come a long way as far as becoming educated. I think that there should have been more emphasis placed on education to the Native people even prior to the enrollment, and I think during the past 10, 11, 12 years, I think that there's been a lack of an overall educational era that should have covered all these fallacies, false dreams or whatever that they might have had, because I feel that in order for a village corporation to become successful, that it's not necessarily paying of dividends, but it's building the assets for the future of the shareholders, for their offsprings. And I think they'll find when the questionnaire is compiled by C. Alaska that the Native people historically have methods of taking care of their own. They always stick together and look after each other. Regardless, I don't think that anybody's going to become rich, but I think they'll find that over a period of time that they'll all work together and share their wealth, be it knowledge or monetary. And I thank you for this opportunity to speak to the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Thank you very much.
Frederick Williams from Ketchikan again. I'd readdress the commission. My first statement had to do with the fact that
I felt that a deal made under force was no deal at all. And in light of the fact that we are still under force, the deal is in effect. And I would like to say that as far as the Alaska Native claims affecting me as a citizen of Ketchikan, the people in this area have not been given a corporation of their own. We were one of the few villages in Alaska that was denied a corporate status. We were given a tag-along status with Sea Alaska. We're members of Sea Alaska the same as every member of every other corporation is a member of Sea Alaska. And I feel this is still an undecided issue as to whether Sea Alaska belongs to Ketchikan or whether Ketchikan is yet to get its own corporation. The problems here being one of the people in power not wanting the natives in Ketchikan to have a power of their own. And so it seems to be that every effort was made to keep power away from the natives of Ketchikan and to keep us disunited so that we couldn't have the power to stand up for ourselves and just be on equal status with the Caucasian people in town who do have the power and are jealous of it. Power being as it is, it was kept away from the people in Ketchikan. And we've got a unique problem here that it was definitely native lands. The people that started the first mill at the mouth of Ketchikan Creek traded with natives to get that land. And the natives were never really recognized. We do all come from many different areas. We've got many different nationalities as far as we're all natives. Tlingits, Haidas, Tsimshians. Tlingits are broken down into different groups. And we've yet to be united, and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act hasn't answered our claims. We claim this land as Native people, and we've yet to receive answer to that claim. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes.
I would like to know, now if the lands are given over to IRA in trust, what does that make us? I mean, how is the federal government going to approach that trust?
Well,
being asked if under some other terms we have to be considered incompetent.
Well, in some of the villages we've been to, people have said, why don't we have the corporations transfer land to IRA councils? Then it would be held in trust by the federal government for the native people, could not be lost through the sale of shares in 1991 and would not be liable to tax. Now, that's one proposal. I have asked that, in fact, we have had Native leaders and lawyers from other countries come to Anchorage at the public roundtable discussions that some of you have seen on television, to talk about trust arrangements in those other countries. For instance, in Australia, the Aboriginal people of Australia, who are now just starting to settle their land claims, are putting the land in trust. But the trust is not a federal government trust. The trust is a trust which is controlled by the elders, and they hold the land in trust for the people. Then there are other kinds of trusts that have been proposed, the whole object being to ensure that if in 1991 corporations or any of them were to fall into the hands of non-Native persons, Native ancestral lands in Alaska would still be held by and for the benefit of Native people. Now, it may be, as Mr. Thompson, who just spoke before Mr. Williams, it may be, as Mr. Thompson says, that the legislation as it now stands, the amendments that ANILCA made to ANCSA, forgive me for using this alphabet soup way of speaking, but you kind of get into the habit here in Alaska. Mr. Thompson said, well, under the ANILCA amendments, the corporations can now buy back the shares that people might want to sell in 1991. That point has been made at other meetings. At Sitka the other night, that point was made, and somebody else said, well, they'd still have to have the money to buy back the shares. And what if Weyerhaeuser came in and made a counteroffer to those shareholders who wanted to sell? It might be difficult for a Native corporation to meet Weyerhaeuser's offer. Mr. Thompson says, well, Weyerhaeuser wouldn't come in because they know that under Section 7I, they have to share certain profits with other regional corporations, and so on and so forth. Well, it makes for a good discussion, and I'm only being long-winded about it because for those people who aren't satisfied with what Mr. Thompson has said, who say, well, maybe it wouldn't work out that way. Maybe outsiders could come in and take over our corporations. They say, to be sure, we should have the corporations transfer the land before 1991 arrives in trust for the Native people, whether it's IRA councils, whether it is trusts composed of elders, or whether it is some other kind of trust. Now, that's the kind of thing you should decide for yourselves. You've had experience with IRAs here in Southeast Alaska. The opinion about IRAs varies in this state. Some people think they are a good way of holding the land. Others are not at all sure about that. And that's why we're going around having this this public discussion about these questions. Yes, sir.